Our reading today is a transcription of a podcast called How to Be a Girl. The podcaster calls herself Marlo Mack, although that is a pseudonym, to protect her child. In particular, her child is probably now 8 or 9, I believe. But when Marlo Mack's child was about 3, they started saying, Mommy, I think that maybe there was a mistake. I need to go back in your tummy. Because, see, her child had been born with boy biology, but felt sure that she was a girl. So this podcast tells this story of the process of Marlo coming to terms with that and eventually saying, okay, you can be the girl that you feel you are. I didn't pick the first podcast of where Marlo Mack is describing, discovering this and finding all that out and eventually saying yes. I picked one a couple, like about a year later, called Tomboy Trans Girl. So imagine we're a little further into the journey. When my daughter was born, we thought she was a boy because she had boy parts. Then, when my apparently male child said he wanted to wear pretty dresses like the ones the girls were wearing, and that in fact he was a girl, we all freaked out. Everyone I knew assumed it was a phase, and so did I. We all kept looking for clues that there was actually a boy underneath all that pink. Even though everything my child loved was completely girly, my family and friends would watch my child playing and remark on how energetic he was, how strong, confident, active. Like a boy, they'd say. Now, if she had been born with female biology, we would never suggest she might be a boy just because she liked to climb trees and roughhouse, or stage an epic battle between her princesses and fairy dolls. We'd call her a tomboy, and up to a certain point, that would be considered a great thing. My child knew right away she was going to have to fight her way into the girl club, and once she got there, she was very careful not to lose her spot. This meant she refused to wear pants for 2 years. Every day, it had to be a skirt or a dress, even to ride her bike, even to climb trees, even to go sledding, like a little girl from the Victorian era, tromping off through the snow in layers of skirts. It didn't matter that all the other girls at preschool wore pants most of the days, or that most of the grown women she knew did too. She knew what she was up against. But recently, at the tail end of kindergarten, things began to shift. She started getting really interested in Pokemon and ninjas. She told me she didn't like princesses anymore, and that her favorite color was now blue, not pink. I showed her a few episodes of Xena, Warrior Princess, and she started begging me to get her a Chakram, the frisbee-shaped weapon that Xena uses to defeat her enemies. And then one day, she started wearing pants, after 2 full years. Now, I remember my cousin's daughter did the same thing. At age 6, my cousin was relieved that the princess phase had finally come to an end. But for my kid, I wasn't relieved. I was scared. I started thinking, had the girl thing itself been a phase? Was my child actually a boy after all? Had we screwed up at letting her change genders so young? What if she's changed her mind? I didn't want her to change her mind. I'd already said goodbye to my son. I didn't want to say goodbye to my daughter now. I know, it sounds strange. I mean, love shouldn't have a gender. But I still didn't want to lose my little girl. Of course, my kid needs to be whoever he or she needs to be. And it's not up to me. So I told her the other day that some people change their minds, even more than once. And some kids decide to stay somewhere in the middle. And I'll love her no matter what she decides to do. She looked at me like I was the world's biggest fool. She said, Mama, most people who like Xena are boys. but I'm a girl who likes Xena. I hadn't said a word about Xena, but she knew. She knew Mom was having doubts, and why. And what she already understands at age 6, far better than her mother does, apparently, is that being a girl isn't about what you wear or what games you like to play. It's something else. I'm not really sure what else, actually. But my child seems to know. Or she at least knows who she is. And she feels good about it. So I'll settle for that. I was only 7, and already I got that it made no sense. More than anything that year, I wanted to carry the cross up the center aisle, or at least a candle. I wanted to go in front of the priest behind the lay leader. I just wanted to be there, walking in that processional that opened Sunday Mass. I wanted to wear the white robes and the rope tied around my waist, and I wanted to sit up there beside the priest in the special seat. I wanted to help swing the silver container back and forth. You know, the one that makes everything smell holy, like Jesus after the Magi visited. It didn't have to be a Sunday. I would have settled for a weekday Mass. But it didn't matter. I mean, there was no day of the week when girls could be altar boys. Boys. Those stinky, greasy goof-offs. None of whom could recite the rosary by heart. Boys got to sit in the special seat. Boys got to open the book of prayers and see up close that flat, stale wafer turning magically into Jesus's body. Boys could be altar boys, not girls. So no matter how many books I read or extra classes I took or how well I demonstrated my serious devotion and heart of service, there was nothing I could do about it because I was a girl. Now, being the proto-feminist and proto-Unitarian Universalist that I was, I decided to write a letter. A letter to the person I figured was in charge of such decisions, my archbishop. I explained in rational, reasonable terms just how ridiculous these rules were and how capable I was. I left out the part about the boys being stinky. I guess I didn't really think he'd write back, which he didn't. And I didn't really think he'd change the rules. That didn't actually happen until I was a senior in high school. But it did happen. I wrote to him because I wanted him to know that someone was paying attention. Someone saw the truth. Even if it was a 7-year-old in a small town in rural Washington, I wanted him to know that someone realized these rules made no sense. We could do so much better. We learn gender early and then throughout our lives. We learn the rules, religious and relational, professional and proper. We learn how gender goes along with sex. Sex parts, I mean, though the other two. Now, gender is not the same as anatomy, but we learn it should be. It normally is. Boys have a penis, girls have a vagina, and boys and girls each have roles and behaviors and outfits that go along with those parts. I was probably 12, maybe 13, when I realized I was too big for a girl. And I don't just mean my body. I took up too much space, talked too loudly, wanted to win too badly, enjoyed it too much when I did. Like the mom in our reading describes, up to a certain point, a girl who has some boy qualities is acceptable, appreciated even, but there's a line. No one told me that I'd crossed it, but I knew. For most of us, and for most of our lives, these sort of gender learning moments remain subconscious. We learn gender mostly by osmosis. It seeps in. without us even realizing, like race or class and all sorts of other cultural norms. We don't realize how much we're learning and teaching and then reinforcing and performing until we're all experts in a language that doesn't yet have words, hardly even knowing what we know. Now, if you came of age sometime after 1990, which is a few of you, I believe, we've come to the point in the sermon you've likely been anticipating ever since you heard I'd be preaching on gender. Because this is the part where I talk about Judith Butler. Right? And then there's the rest of you that are, depending on how engaged you are in gender theory or feminist philosophy, are going, gender, Judith who? Judith Butler is the author of the book Gender Trouble, Feminism and the Subversion of Identity, which was published in 1990. And almost immediately, it altered the whole conversation around gender and gender identity, so much so that it would basically be negligent to preach a sermon called Queering Gender that didn't at least mention Judith Butler. Gender Trouble, if you go try to buy it after the service today, you'll quickly realize it's an incredibly dense and gorgeous piece of academic writing that I can't even bring you direct quotes from because, well, we want you to all keep staying with me in the sermon. So instead, I'm going to try to sum it up in three short bullets. Here it goes. So first, she asserted that gender is not a fixed binary at birth. It's a continuum that may or may not correspond to your biological sex. Two, she said, gender is not something you are, it's something you do. Which is to say, gender is performative. And three, the habitual ways that we perform gender in turn creates expectations and sets and resets norms around gender. Or to put it another way, gender is culturally and socially constructed. It's interesting because I think in some way some of this has become relatively culturally known, but it really was a breaking point when Judith Butler began to, she put her work out there. So that after that point, you really couldn't speak about gender without acknowledging those three points. Now, Judith Butler was on my mind when I first started watching the TV series Mad Men. If any of you watch Mad Men, it is the story of ad executives in New York in the 1960s. By ad executives, of course, I mean ad men, thus the wordplay in the title. The whole first season, I was sure that it had to be exaggerated. Overly performed. I mean, gender roles couldn't ever have been that prescribed and pronounced, could they? Right, I asked this question out loud to my mother-in-law one day because I knew she'd watched it and she was a young adult in the 1960s and she was like, just like you. Oh yeah, it was just like that. My mouth dropped. That's for real? Men said that stuff to women? And it was okay. She said, we didn't really even think about it. Now, from my perspective, you know, someone who was 7 in 1983 and appalled that girls couldn't be altar boys, there is no way that being a girl or a woman in the way Mad Men prescribes could happen without even thinking about it. It would take a lot of performance, like Oscar level. But incredibly, for many who grew up in the 50s and 60s, they didn't really think about it. And that is one of the amazing tricks about gender. It is culturally prescribed, profoundly variable based on the where and the when, and yet somehow it gets conveyed to us as if it is eternal and biologically predestined. Like, of course. Like, it's the air we breathe. This is what Butler means by gender being performative, not that we consciously perform gender, except maybe on days like today, but more that we are trained and retrained, consciously and subconsciously, for what it means to be a boy or a girl, so much so that we don't even realize it's happening. Or at least, most of us don't. The late, great peace activist, Dr. Vincent Harding, one of my professors in seminary, used to look over a room of predominantly white students and invite them to think about race. Not someone else's race, but their own. He'd ask them to think about those moments when they first learned race. The rules about race, who hangs out with whom, why, and assumptions about behaviors and roles. For the people of color in the room, the stories were easy and ongoing. For the white folks, however, it took a while. It took a while to push through what had felt like a given for most of their lives. That is, the privilege of not having to think about race. But soon enough, it happened. Stories started to spill out. Stories of little children realizing they couldn't or shouldn't be friends with that child. Sneers, both obvious and subtle, from grandparents, neighbors, and the TV news. People were able to trace their lives by these stories. Even the white people, eager, open-hearted children becoming rule-bound, race-bound, rigid, and fixed, and then as adults attempting to unlearn, relearn, and break open once again. Our stories of learning gender aren't exactly the same as race, but there's a parallel. Because for some of us, like my mother-in-law, we hardly think about it. There's enough synergy in our genuine sense of self and what is culturally prescribed to keep those lessons subconscious. But then for others of us, the rules of gender are a daily awareness of being, at best, as Sean said last week, a gender spy. Of course, some spies pass more easily as natives than others, which means that some of us must learn to live in bodies that are not so easily disguised and are therefore dangerous themselves. Between these two ends of the spectrum, there's all sorts of in-between and variation across all of our lifetime. Because most of us will have at least one experience when gender is barely a consideration, when we don't need to think about it. And then at least another where gender and gender norms hit us and our spirit like a brick wall, stopping us in our tracks. And when that happens too often, we don't do as I did as a 7-year-old and think the rule itself makes no sense, but rather more like I did when I was 12, thinking that we must be the problem. It isn't until we are offered a whole new story, a new paradigm of possibility for gender expression and life liberation, if by then our hearts aren't too closed up in closets of shame, only then we start to imagine it isn't something in us that's broken or bent, but that, as Butler said, gender is much more complicated, that is to say, beautiful, and need not be restricted by labels or boxes, pronouns, or prior performance. I was 18. When I first saw her, I said something embarrassing, which she teased me about endlessly for the next 23 years. Probably longer, we'll see. I didn't know what to make of her, with her androgynous features, her intensity, and her girlfriend. It was 1993, but I hadn't read Judith Butler yet. I was just trying to wake up, trying to become, trying to tell the truth. Except I didn't know what the truth was, which is not to say it already existed, and I just had to do my best Christopher Columbus impression and discover it somewhere inside me. That's not how selfhood works, at least not in my observation or experience. The journey of self-discovery is not just a journey to understand something pre-existing, but also one that in and of itself creates, so that when you go looking for your truest self, it's already changing and changed. Simply by your beginning that journey. The woman I met my freshman year in college, I didn't even know that women could look or act like she did. Not on purpose. It was like my brain exploded, and I was both terrified and thrilled. My mom, bless her heart, used to ask me if my friend wanted to be a man. or to look like a man. Was she the man? I used to get so irritated at her. But really, it is confusing once gender gets troubled, once the lines are blurred, and in the past few decades, gender has been incredibly troubled, or queered, if you will. I think about Mad Men, or when I watch the early 20th century women's fashion scene in Wonder Woman. Have you seen it? Okay, go. So good. But I think about these scenes and I compare it to our world today, and I cannot believe how much has changed. You might have seen the Time magazine cover story in March this year that explored how children and youth in the U.S. today are claiming a great variety of labels to describe their gender, beyond male or female or even trans. There's also agender, gender fluid, gender queer, two-spirit, non-binary. I mean, just this past week, the state of Oregon officially added a third gender option for driver's licenses so that you can register now there as male, female, or non-binary, which is nothing compared to the gender options on Facebook. 50, last I checked. The article in Time arrived a couple months after an even more in-depth consideration of gender printed in National Geographic, titled Gender Revolution. The cover shows a girl presenting kid, maybe 9 or 10, pink hair, whose story mirrors the story that Marlo Mack tells in her podcast about a kid who feels not like a boy who likes girl things, but says insistently, "I am a boy. I am a girl." In our own congregation, we've had at least 3 of our youth come out as trans. And you'll see the genderqueer display in the foyer features one of our members, Kendra. As National Geographic editor Susan Goldberg says, everywhere we look in the U.S. and around the globe, individuals and organizations are fighting to redefine traditional gender roles. And many people are rejecting binary boy-girl labels to find their true identity somewhere else on a gender spectrum. While I certainly agree with her, what I appreciate most about Goldberg's description is the word fighting. Much has changed. Gender has become, in many ways, less prescriptive and restrictive. But gender justice remains an active question, an ongoing struggle, a fight. As a personal example, while I am grateful to be serving in a denomination where women can process up the center aisle, maybe not with a cross, we are, in fact, the only denomination in the U.S. with a majority female ministry. But still, it is not a simple thing to be a female-identified clergy person. I'm always aware that most of the world, even in our progressive community, holds an explicit or implicit understanding that ministers are male. Not many people say it out loud, of course. Only a few in our congregation have been so bold to remind me that although I'm a fine minister and they like me, they just really prefer a man. You may have noticed that on most days, not today, obviously, I don't try to fool you. As I told one member who asked me my first year here why I always wear dresses, I like to push on the boundaries of what a minister looks like. And to be clear that not only can a minister be female, but also femme. Now last week, Sean said that his goal was like Harvey Milk, to recruit you. And I'm no less evangelical in my aim, because it is a fight. In fact, with the rise of Donald Trump, the forces of sexism and misogyny and gender policing have received a boost of renewed legitimacy, which sounds like it's mostly a problem for women, but seriously, doesn't it seem like the box for acceptable male behavior just keeps getting smaller? I mean, really, this is a problem for all of us. And Time magazine covers, notwithstanding, check the statistics and stories about the violence, harassment, and likelihood of suicide for gender nonconforming people, and you'll quickly realize that for many of our neighbors, it's not simply a fun Sunday morning exercise to play with gender. It's dangerous and even life-threatening. which is why it's time that we who affirm the inherent worth of all people, the inherent beauty of all gender expressions, and the free and ongoing search for our truest selves, it is time for us to rise up. And like I try to do with ministerial expectations, push back. It's time for us to remember and share our stories where we learned gender, policed gender, struggled or rejoiced with gender. And it's time to come out about the ways we long to break gender norms in big or small ways. And most of all, it's time to listen to all the kids out there who are still writing letters and living lives, trying to say once and for all, these rules make no sense. So let us be the people that make space where all of us can be free. May it be so, and amen.